This is a CBC podcast.
Hi there, I'm Pia Chattopadhyay. Welcome to the Sunday Magazine podcast featuring the stories we first brought you Sunday, the 22nd of September on CBC Radio. Device detonations in Lebanon have caused confusion, anger, injury, and death. They also show how key technology has become in modern war. First up, what it all reveals about the future of global conflict. After that, Nathan Law fought for democracy in Hong Kong, in the streets, and in politics. Well, now he's one of its most wanted men. Nathan will join me to talk about the prospects for democracy in his home, despite recent rollbacks on rights. Donald Trump bills himself as a self-made billionaire, but as Canadian journalist Suzanne Craig will explain, her investigation tells a far different story about the former president's wealth. And later, one of Canada's great historical fiction authors, Guy Vanderhaeghe, shares his own story. It all starts right now on the Sunday Magazine. It was something straight out of a Hollywood spy movie. Pagers exploding. A day later, walkie-talkies and radios began blowing up, all remotely detonated. According to the Lebanese Health Ministry, 37 people died in these explosions, and 3,000 injured. Those numbers include some civilians. And while Israel has not publicly claimed responsibility, that country's defense minister said a new era of war was beginning in its fight with Hezbollah. So, for the Middle East, Ukraine, and beyond, how are advances in technology changing the way conflicts are being fought, and what does it mean for future wars? Christopher Kirchhoff helped found the U.S. Pentagon's Defense Innovation Unit and served as the Director of Strategic Planning for the National Security Council during Barack Obama's presidency. He is also co-author of the new book called Unit X, How the Pentagon and Silicon Valley Are Transforming the Future of War. Chris, good morning to you.
Good morning, Pia.
These explosions seem to surprise and shock so many people, but with your expertise, how surprised were you?
No, it's really interesting to have watched technology progress so rapidly on the battlefield. And, you know, to those that are following closely, it actually wasn't a surprise at all. The attacks, although spectacular and certainly, out of a spy thriller in many respects, are, in some senses, they've been technically possible actually for quite some time. So this is a classic sort of sabotage attack. You're interdicting, a device through a supply chain. And because we all live in a world where everything is connected, you're able to implant malware and then remotely trigger a cyber attack. So this sort of thing has actually been possible since quite literally the introduction of cell phones 20 years ago, right? But what's interesting about military technology is oftentimes what happens on the battlefield is 10 or 20 or even 30 years sort of behind the state of the art of technology. There's a bit of a lag. We've seen this throughout history, and I think the pager attack is the most recent example of it.
A lot of people were commenting about the use of pagers and walkie-talkies in our modern age, which seems sort of like rudimentary. But in terms of pulling this off technically, how sophisticated was this operation?
Well, I think the unnerving reality is that, hacking devices is something that, even high school students are often able to pull off. It's remarkable. I mean, there's this property of computer code. Computer code inherently contains a certain number of errors in it, every so many lines of computer code. And what that means for us is that inevitably any computer program has a lot of vulnerabilities in it that no one knows about. So this place is all in a situation where it's quite possible to exploit most things, which is why cybersecurity is such a challenge.
Okay, so that worries people. And we saw that in Lebanon, right? Hezbollah's leader Hassan Nasrallah told his members about 6 months ago to stop carrying cell phones because it allows them to be tracked and that their communications could be monitored. But we saw regular Lebanese people just being nervous and scared to walk around with their cell phone in their hand or their pocket after that. So are you telling me that no communication device, no matter where you are in the world today, is 100% safe?
I mean, I think any cybersecurity would say that about anything that has code in it. It's not, though, a question of everything being absolutely unsafe. I mean, there's incredible efforts, right, that companies, governments are putting forward to protect our digital world so that we can go about our lives without fear of dramatic disruption. So there are layers of protection. But I think it would be too strong of a statement to say that we can secure everything everywhere all the time.
I want to ask you about some other advances in technology as it pertains to being used in conflict or, supposedly might be used in conflict. So I want to start with Pegasus, which is this Israeli spyware company that's got quite a lot of attention. It's been accused of selling its technology to autocratic regimes in order to monitor dissidents, but it has been used in other ways as well. How dangerous are advances in these kinds of cyber weapons?
Well, I think it's important here to distinguish between many different kinds of uses that we put cyber tools, let's call them, to use. So a cyber weapon is generally thought about as something that creates a sort of a kinetic effect in the world. In other words, that crosses over from the digital to the physical. So, the classic example of this, which of course is now out in the public domain, is Stuxnet, where a joint U.S.-Israeli operation was designed to interfere with the speed at which centrifuges were spinning in an Iranian nuclear enrichment facility, causing them to explode. And this was done to, in an attempt anyway, to slow Iran's ability to move towards making a nuclear weapon. So that would be considered, in my mind and in the minds of experts in the field, an actual cyber attack, used by a cyber weapon. Pegasus spyware issue you describe, which by the way is not just about the company Pegasus. It's there are hundreds of companies around the world and groups that produce tools like this for all kinds of purposes. And by the way, they're used lawfully in a number of occasions. So law enforcement in both the U.S. and Canada will use these same kind of tools in the course of an investigation to, for instance, break open the phone of somebody that's suspected of murder or another very, very serious crime. So this sort of category of cyber tools is much more about gaining access to information. It's not really about achieving a kinetic effect in the world. Mm.
Okay, I want to ask you about drones because we've seen them being used in conflicts that are ongoing right now in Europe between Israel and Hamas. There was that enormous drone attack by Iran on Israel back in April. I think, even a few short years ago, a lot of lay people would see that as such a futuristic thing, and here we are. So describe for me the role drones are currently playing out on battlefields and sort of what you foresee for the future.
Well, this is another wonderful illustrative example of technological diffusion on the battlefield. The modern sort of consumer drone ecosystem began about 25 years ago. In fact, the first drone operating systems were written by graduate students at MIT in about 2000 or 2001. And the great lowering of cost of global supply chains that allows low-cost hardware all of a sudden produced, what we call consumer hobbyist drones. So you or I can go to, Best Buy or an electronics retailer, and we can buy a drone probably from DJI, a Chinese company, which has the vast majority of the market share because their drones are by far many generations ahead technologically of everything else on the market. And that drone, it can follow us around as we're hiking or skiing. It uses very sophisticated guidance systems to maneuver, gyroscopes, so on and so forth. It basically has as much electronics as a modern day fighter jet. And we can buy this for a few hundred dollars. It's wonderful, right? There's wonderful things we can do in terms of recreating with drones. But we have to remember that the same diffusion of this technology to low price points around the world means inevitably that they're going to show up on battlefields. And indeed, they've been showing up in battlefields for a very long time, from Iraq and Afghanistan into Syria. And now, of course, in a very dramatic fashion in Ukraine and the Middle East.
Yeah, we saw this past week a large-scale Ukrainian drone attack on Russia, and it reportedly triggered an earthquake-sized blast at an ammunition depot. So I think what I'm hearing from you is that there will be more of these kinds of uses of drones in future conflicts and the ones that we're having today.
Well, Ukraine is the the place to look closely and to really study what's happening, because it has become unquestionably the first drone war that we're seeing, where both sides are engaging each other with all kinds of drones, not just the big, sophisticated military drones that have been increasing parts of the arsenal of modern militaries, but very low-cost drones that are often made literally in garage shops. So if you wander around Kyiv today, or Lviv, a city in the west of Ukraine, there are hundreds of companies that are each developing very low-cost drones of all kinds. Surveillance drones that are designed to capture footage of targets in the battlefield, kamikaze drones that, with remarkable precision, can fly through even electronic warfare defenses and often strike targets. And these drones are often used in tandem, kind of like, a surveillance spy satellite directing, a modern day fighter jet. And they're doing really remarkable things. So, for example, the United States provided earlier this year the Ukrainians with 31 M1 A1 Abrams battle tanks. This is the most advanced battle tank in the world, in the arsenal of the United States or any of our allies. And the Ukrainians have had to pull those tanks back from the front lines after so many of them were destroyed by Russian kamikaze drones. So we're at a point where inexpensive drones are all of a sudden taking off the battlefield, one of the most important pieces of military hardware in the arsenal of modern militaries.
You know, it's interesting that you bring that up, because our military, like many militaries around the world, is trying to modernize and catch up. And so we just, for example, the Canadian military is getting 88 F-35 fighter jets. The manufacturer calls them the next generation of Canadian air power. But given what you just said, is the purchase of fighter jets like an F-35 a good investment for modern militaries?
Well, we're at this incredible moment of change in how technology is produced, and it's very important to put this in historical perspective. So if we rewind the tape to the end of the Cold War, that was a moment when governments around the world, particularly the United States government, were spending an enormous amount on research and development in federal labs. And because of that investment, the best technology in the world was coming from places like DARPA, the Defense Advanced Projects Research Agency, which, among other things, invented the internet and stealth technology. But around the late 1990s and the early 2000s, that began to shift quite dramatically as the tech industry rose in importance and became a larger share of the economy. And over time, by the time we get to about 2015, which is when the Pentagon established its first office in Silicon Valley called Defense Innovation Unit, companies that we all know, the name brand companies, Amazon, Google, Microsoft, were each themselves spending more on research and development than the United States military. And in fact, they themselves were bigger by market capitalization than the whole defense industry combined. So we're now in a world in which technology, innovation is primarily coming from the civilian sector, not from military labs.
If you're just joining us this morning, I'm Pia Chattopadhyay, and I'm speaking with Christopher Kirchhoff. Christopher helped found the Pentagon's Defense Innovation Unit. About the changing face of warfare is what we're talking about. Okay, Chris, so we have to talk about AI. there's a lot of fear about AI sort of generally. How is AI changing the battlefield?
Well, to go back to those F-35s that Canada just purchased, they are unquestionably the best fighter jet in the world. I mean, they're known sort of as a flying computer for their ability to fuse sensor data with weapons. On the other hand, the story of how they're produced figures here. So the F-35's design was actually finalized in the late 1990s, and then the contract to build them was let in 2001. And so, believe it or not, they didn't enter service until about 2016. And when they did, the computer processors in them were actually quite a bit slower than what we carried around in our pocket in 2016 with iPhones and Android phones. So that lag in technology plays also into AI. So AI today, again, is primarily produced in a small number of corporate labs, a lot of which are actually very close to here where I live in San Francisco. And there is now a great race by militaries to experiment with artificial intelligence in the battlefield. And that revolution is driven, again, remarkably by technology developed by civilians, not by the military.
So we know many countries, China and Russia, are also working on their own artificial intelligence initiatives as it pertains to the battlefield. But it's sort of like an AI arms race. Is that a fair way to put it?
I think that's exactly the way to put it. And this AI arms race is enabling spectacular changes on the battlefield. So, you know, how is it that a kamikaze drone that may, you know, perhaps cost $2,000 or $3,000 can quite reliably kill the most advanced battle tank in the world that, you know, costs $12 or $13 million to produce? Well, it has very sophisticated sensors in it that allow it to identify the signature of that tank, to seek it out, and then to steer itself there. And some of these technologies involve AI. So machine learning is really important here because it allows computers to see, to literally see and recognize images. And the cost of implementing a sort of a seeker that matches the signature of a tank to its actual target is now quite inexpensive. And so that's why we're seeing folks in garages in Kyiv and Lviv in Ukraine able to, for pennies on the dollar, produce systems that just a few years ago only superpowers would have been able to produce.
One of the fears about AI in many realms, but in this one as well, is that as it learns, it will be able to make autonomous decisions. How concerned should we be that a glitch, if I can put it that way, could start an accidental war when it comes to AI?
Well, we've all seen, you know, thanks to Hollywood, a lot of the killer robot movies, right? And we all know how they end, right? The robot takes over. So, yeah, of course, it's really important to pay attention to autonomy in any system. But it's also really important to point out that sometimes autonomy actually delivers really important benefits for military systems. Autonomy sometimes allows systems, particularly in what military analysts call contested environments, where communication may not be reliable, to make far smarter decisions, decisions that, for instance, may actually be able to allow the more precise targeting of military assets and help drive down civilian casualties and collateral damage. So autonomy isn't necessarily always a bad thing. But to bring it back to your question, you know, about what really is about accidental escalation, we wouldn't want to get into a situation where there was an autonomous system that kind of went haywire and behaved in a way that we didn't anticipate it to. And of course, in artificial intelligence, and anybody who's tried to use, say, ChatGPT or another generative AI bot has sometimes might have noticed, you know, a wrong answer. The bot might have hallucinated and delivered erroneous information. And so we obviously don't, we can't yet safely deploy autonomous systems unless we know reliably they're going to perform well. So that's the great challenge with deploying autonomy safely on the battlefield.
Mm. This might sound like a question out of an Isaac Asimov novel, but can you see the day when wars will be fought entirely by robots and AI?
You know, I think I can, and it's not just me. In fact, the stepped down chairman of the Joint Chiefs of Staff in the United States, General Mark Milley, the last year of his chairmanship went around giving a number of speeches talking about how we are moving into a world in which we are going to see autonomy increasingly deployed by each of the military services. So the Army will certainly be deploying robots on the battlefield. The United States Air Force is in the process of purchasing 10,000 autonomous supersonic drones that are able to swarm and fly together with manned fighter aircraft. They're called collaborative combat aircraft. So Canada has, of course, just bought F-35s, but F-35s are now actually being supplanted by new aerial doctrine that calls for them to fly with autonomous drones. So we are going to see things shift quite a bit. And this actually could be a good thing because it could take humans out of harm's way.
Meaning that what, these technologies could be more precise?
More precise and enable the same sort of military outcomes without putting soldiers, airmen, you know, and Marines at great risk.
Christopher, you're a person who not only imagines, but you study future battlefields and the weapons that are being used and might be used in the future. So, you know, it's been a hard time with global conflict for so many people around the world. As you look at the world, what's keeping you up at night?
Well, of course, waking up this morning to the news of the increasingly serious exchanges between Hezbollah and Israel is extremely worrying. The Middle East is, of course, it's been a tremendously fraught place for a long time and grown even more fraught since the attacks by Hamas on October 7th in Israel. And I think what people need to remember is, modern weapons are horrendously destructive. And unfortunately, there's a lot of them in the world. Mm. And so we should all be doing all we can to prevent the outbreak of violent conflict, particularly conflict between great powers. I mean, the same chairman I referenced, General Milley, is fond of also reminding everyone that no one among us has really lived through, is currently serving as a diplomat or in a military today, through great power war. And he repeats all the time that, between World War I and World War II and the years in between, nearly 150 million people lost their lives. And so it should be our goal to use technology to deter war, to make sure that the calculus of the battlefield is that your adversary does not want to go to war with you because the cost would be so catastrophic.
Christopher, thank you for your expertise this morning. Really appreciate it.
Enjoy joining you. Thank you, Priya.
Christopher Kirchhoff is the founder of the Pentagon's Defense Innovation Unit, and he also served as the Director of Strategic Planning for the National Security Council during the Obama administration. He has a new book out. It is called Unit X, How the Pentagon and Silicon Valley Are Transforming the Future of War. I'm Pia Chattopadhyay. You're listening to the Sunday Magazine podcast. Well, 10 years ago this week, protesters took to the streets of Hong Kong, calling for more democratic freedom and less Chinese involvement in their affairs. It began with university and high school students demonstrating against China's move to restrict candidate nominations in Hong Kong's election. But the crowd swelled into the tens of thousands, and the protests went on for 79 days. This became known as the Umbrella Movement, named for the umbrellas protesters used to protect themselves against pepper spray being used by police. Nathan Law rose to prominence as one of its student leaders, earning him global attention as well as the eye of Beijing. 2 years later, Nathan Law became Hong Kong's youngest ever elected legislator, and not long after, one of its most wanted men. And he still is. Today, Nathan lives in exile in the United Kingdom with a bounty on his head. His story is captured in a new documentary called Who's Afraid of Nathan Law? Nathan, good morning to you.
Good morning, Pia. Thank you for having me.
It's nice to have a chance to talk to you. And I want to begin by going back a decade. This is you on a makeshift stage at the protest. Nathan, you're saying Hong Kongers will not be pushed around. I want the right to vote, fight, and never give up. You were 21 years old at the time. Activism, at least at that scale, was new to you. So 10 years on, what goes through your mind when you hear your younger self there?
It's been a decade, but it feels like it's been a century because in the past 10 years, I've evolved from a young protest leader, student leader, to a legislator, and then to a cellmate in prison, and for now an exile activist. There have been lots of unexpected turns of my life. And if you asked me 10 years ago whether I would kind of imagine myself living overseas being wanted with a bounty, I would definitely answer you. You are just like being nonsense. But that is how reality unfolds. So definitely it feels really, really long time ago.
So you were born in mainland China, and when you were 6 years old, you and your mom moved to Hong Kong, where your father was from. Your family wasn't particularly political, so where did your initial interest in activism even come from?
Yeah, my father came to Hong Kong from mainland China in the late 70s. He and my mother, they still had that kind of refugee mentality, which from my growing up, what they had taught me in my family education was to just be steady, don't rock the boat, and then just try to finish college, get a good job, etc. So they never taught me anything about democracy or human rights or trying to convince me to be involved in social affairs. But it was not until when I was in high school, I learned the story of Liu Xiaobo, the Chinese activist dissident who got a Nobel Peace Prize in 2010, and also the story of the Tiananmen Massacre taking place in 1989, then I realized that as a college student, I have a certain responsibility to be vocal about our future and campaign for social change. So that was the start of my political enlightenment.
And I want to remind our listeners about the context around your activism. When Britain handed control of Hong Kong back to China in 1997, the agreement was that Hong Kong would keep its existing economic, legal, and social systems for the next 50 years. China would make decisions about defense and foreign affairs. But then 17 years later, so in 2014, China restricts nominations for the head of government in Hong Kong, essentially meaning that Beijing would need to endorse candidates to secure a spot on the ballot. Nathan, what was it about that move, particularly, that frustrated, maddened, scared you so much and turned your, you know, your activism, which had been sort of growing a little bit, but not to this extent, what turned that interest in activism into this kind of action?
I think back then, Hong Kong people felt a deep sense of betrayal because there was a trust in the system, in the idea that if we live under this one country, two system, which is the governing system after Hong Kong was handed back to the Chinese regime, then we will eventually enjoy the things that Beijing promised. But of course, they never delivered, and it triggered a huge discontent of Hong Kong people, and it was embedded to a sense of betrayal and the eagerness of seeking that a promise. For me, being involved in student activism was initially a one-year thing. So when I was elected as a representative of my college student union, and I thought that, wow, after a year of service, I would be back to my normal, ordinary student life and focusing on my GPA, trying to get an exchange program, etc. But it was the time when I was a student representative that the umbrella movement took place, that the big era, the era of resistance, civil disobedience of Hong Kong emerged. And many of us, we were kind of dragged into this political storm and was never able to leave, because when you were conceded as a student activist, student leader, that there were so many people putting their trust and hope in you.
You were out on the streets leading this protest for weeks on end. I know there were other leaders as well, Agnes Chow and Joshua Wong, your good friend who's still in prison. But is it really true that your mom didn't know you were involved in these protests?
So there was a funny story. Initially, I lied about my whereabouts when I was doing protests, because my mom, I know that she would be upset and she didn't approve that. So whenever I went to protest, I told her that I was spending time with my friend, I was playing football, etc. And the time when she found out that what I was involved was when I was arrested on 26th September 2014. As you heard it in the clip, that was exactly the night that I was arrested for my participation in the Umbrella Movement. My mom was in a wedding boutique, and you know, like in these Chinese big restaurant, they had these televisions hanging over the ceiling. And when my mom was having fun with her friends and she looked up, she saw her son being arrested by the police, and she was so shocked. And that was the time when she found out that even though I was like deeply involved in the movement and in the student activism for more than half a year, she finally realized that I was actually the one holding the mic and being exposed to these police arrest and mm-hmm. political persecution.
Wow. That's a way to find out about what your kid is up to. So 79 days after the protest began, Hong Kong's High Court ordered police to clear demonstration sites. And the Hong Kong government did not end up making the concessions to the demands of the Umbrella Movement. I know a lot has happened in the last 10 years, but when you look back at, you know, having a goal and not being able to achieve them, how do you measure the protest success?
Social movement is about the power of people against the power of regime. And it is so often that there's a huge imbalance in between them. And most of the time, social movement ended up in failure, that we don't get what we demand, even is fair, is just, and it should be something that the government should do. But that is how the reality is, and what we can do is try to swallow it and to keep campaigning. The legacy of the umbrella movement is huge. It marked the era of civil disobedience, and it was in fact the very first big civil disobedience actions of Hong Kong people. And its influence was not only limited in Hong Kong, but I went to a lot of international conferences. I talked to people who campaigned for democracy in Southeast Asia as well. They were all inspired by the remarkable bravery of the umbrella movement and the creativity and the humanity of it. So I think the rippling effect of that movement, even though we didn't have our demands met, it has impacted a lot of people and triggered a lot more like resistance in the region.
The other thing that happened for you is that it really paved your way for you to enter politics. You and some of your fellow pro-democracy protesters started a political party, and you run in part because you're the only one who's old enough to run for office. And at 23, you become Hong Kong's youngest ever elected legislature. Nathan, what did your time in office show you about the potential and limits of trying to make change from the inside?
For me, living in an undemocratic system, being able to be elected and to speak in the parliament, in the chamber, was a vehicle for me to campaign for larger change outside of the system. So back then, there were only half of the seats in Hong Kong's legislature were through direct election. The rest, most of them were reserved for the probation camp. So whenever we are majority and in the popular election, we ended up minority in the legislature. So for me, being in the legislature didn't really have much power to change things, but it gave me a platform. It gave me an opportunity to show that like protest leaders, they are good at chanting slogans. They are good at mobilizing protesters, mobilizing people. But we are also good at talking about real politics, talking about policy, and we have the capacity to enter into the discussion of how Hong Kong can be better and what good policies can we implement it.
Your time as a legislator was cut short. And just so our audience understands why that was, I want to go back to your swearing in. You take an oath of office like politicians around the world do. But during your oath of office, you include a quote from Mahatma Gandhi. And that addition literally changes the trajectory for you. So 9 months after being elected, you're a legislator. You get disqualified because you added some words that weren't supposed to be in the oath of office. And within a month from that, you're charged, you're sentenced for the 2014 protest for inciting others to take part in an unlawful assembly. You and some other student leaders are sentenced to 6 to 8 months in prison. That's a lot to take in a short period of time.
Yeah, like in a month, you were degraded from an honorable to a cellmate, and it was difficult to swallow. For the disqualification case, it was widely seen as a big intrusion from Beijing into Hong Kong's legal system, because initially the president of the legislature approved my oath. I served the office, I went to meetings, I represent my people. But what had happened was Beijing reinterpreted the constitution and in effect added new restriction on the oath swearing ceremony and applied it retrospectively. So they basically created a legal loophole and legal weapon to disqualify legislators that they don't like, including myself. And that was seen by the international legal community as a big attack to our legal system. And then I then ended up disqualified and went to jail because of my involvement in the umbrella movement. So that was a lot to digest. But for me, it was also a test that whether I can navigate my way in these turbulent times, but still maintain steadied in the way to pursue for my goal and for the democracy of Hong Kong.
And as you're pondering that, you're navigating your way through, are you asking yourself the question, a tough question, but how far am I willing to go for the cause that I believe so deeply in?
Yeah, that's the question I think every activist along the way they ask themselves. And like, I didn't want to become someone who sacrificed so much when I first entered the arena of activism. But it was like step by step, I witnessed so much injustice, I witnessed so much other dedications and devotions from my fellow activists. And I learned that people really wanted to change and the power of activism, so that you gradually be equipped with the kind of mental bandwidth and preparation for more challenges, for more consequences of your actions. So for me, it was definitely gradually I became much more resolute and determined in what I do and the campaign for Hong Kong.
If you're just tuning in, I'm Pia Chattopadhyay, and I'm speaking with pro-democracy activist and former Hong Kong legislator Nathan Law. Nathan, 5 years after the Umbrella Movement, there's another major uprising in Hong Kong. This one was in protest of an extradition bill that would allow suspects to be sent to mainland China for trial. These protests in 2019 are bigger. They are much more violent. For example, the legislature was occupied and vandalized. The police response was strong. Eventually, the bill is withdrawn, but the government passed then a new national security law, severely cracking down on dissent. In many ways, that move, that national security law, changed Hong Kong in enormous ways overnight. Mm. What did you see in the hours and days after the law was passed? What was the mood for Hong Kongers?
In the protests in 2019, there were lots of discontent and anger towards the Beijing government, because Hong Kong people, they were promised democracy and autonomy, but Beijing took them away. So in 2020, when Beijing circumvented all the local legislation and consultation processes and imposed the national security law to Hong Kong people, which is in effect destroying our civil society and basic freedoms of Hong Kong people, we could definitely feel the dangers coming. And that's the reason why I left Hong Kong and ended up in the United Kingdom and getting my political asylum, because if I were to stay in Hong Kong, I would face decades of imprisonment because of my peaceful advocacy work for the democracy and autonomy of Hong Kong. So that was a big blow to Hong Kong people who were so used to living in a free society, freedom of speech, freedom of assembly. But it turns out we've got so many cases where people, they just speak things differently from the Chinese Communist regime, and also trying to organize protest and voicing their opposition to how the city is being run. And they ended up in jail because of their exercising their freedom of speech. And that really scares off a lot of capitals, business, and also Hong Kong people, as we've seen a big exodus of business people and Hong Kong people out of Hong Kong in the past years.
You know, you talk about making the decision to leave. And I just want to ask you about just how difficult that was. I understand that the fear of being imprisoned was what kind of convinced you. That doesn't mean make leaving all that much easier, though.
Yeah, it was 2020. I spent most of my time in the past years campaigning for the democracy of Hong Kong. I was elected. I was jailed. I was campaigning on the street. I led hundreds of thousands of Hong Kong people to protest. And I devoted myself so much in the love of Hong Kong and for the city. And at that time, leaving Hong Kong seemed to be uprooting everything that I've done for the city, and then landed in a completely strange place where you don't know where you're heading, how you can continue your advocacy, and whether you have the capacity to continue to speak up for Hong Kong. So that was a big moment. a difficult decision to make. But eventually I made it because I think that was the best for Hong Kong, because we need people to speak up for the persecuted ones and for the future of Hong Kong. And the only way to do it is to leave Hong Kong and to be active on the international stage. So that was the decision that I made. And I was fortunate enough to continue to preserve my voice and have a platform to campaign for Hong Kong and for those people who are in jail now.
And that is the work you continue to do. That all said, even though you're no longer in Hong Kong, there is an arrest warrant out for you. You're accused of national security offenses, foreign collusion, incitement to secession. There's a bounty on your head. It amounts to 1 million Hong Kong dollars, about $175,000 Canadian. How does that affect you day to day in your life, even though you're abroad? How safe do you feel or not feel?
For me, that is the scare tactics that Beijing adopts, that they try to intimidate me and stop me from speaking up for Hong Kong. And that's why they put me on this wanted list and the bounty, and to make me feel insecure and to feel unsafe, even around my friends who are supposed to just give me space. And for me, it's been difficult. Mm-hmm. But I also have to remind myself, if I stopped, then that would fall into their trap. So I have to have regular conversations and get in touch with security department in every country that I go. And I have connection with the UK government so that whenever they heard anything, that they can inform me immediately. And for me, I try to live a normal life, because that is how I can function and how I can do the things that I wanted to do when I left Hong Kong. So for me, life continues and I try to live as normal as I can be.
You know, listening to you reminds me of a line in the documentary early on when they're talking about the student leaders emerging, yourself included, where it says, Joshua is the heart guy and you're the brain guy. That's how you kind of cope, huh?
Well, I definitely felt like it was an overstatement, but I tried to be as calm and as steady and as analytical as possible, because as I said, social movement, there's a huge power imbalance. And if you cannot be as calm and as steady as you are, then it'll be a very, very difficult role for you. So for me, being in my position, it comes with a lot of pressure, a lot of attention, a lot of stigmatization, a lot of attacks, a lot of people that they wanted to hurt you. And the only thing that you can do is to be as normal-minded as possible and to just follow your consciousness. And that's how I wanted to be myself in the future.
As you know, Canada has a very large diaspora of people from Hong Kong. There were solidarity protests here in both 2014 and 2019. Canada's governments of the day, they were different governments, in both cases were supportive of democracy in Hong Kong for its autonomy and independent judiciary. So what do you see as the role now in 2024 for Canada and other Western democracies as it pertains to Hong Kong?
Well, for Hong Kong people, we definitely would like to have a tougher stance towards the authoritarian expansion of the Chinese regime from these countries, especially when it comes to the issue of Taiwan, when it comes to the issue of transnational repression. We want governments to take a tougher stance. For me, living in United Kingdom, we definitely want more scrutiny of the agents of the Chinese regime in the country, and if it's necessary, then do sanctions on individuals that are responsible for the human rights violations in the city and in the country. And of course, like, offering humanitarian pathway to protesters in need in Hong Kong is also crucial to just help them and to make sure that the issues stays in priority. So I think there are a lot of things that we can do, but at the end of the day, we have to recognize that the threat Hong Kong people are facing is actually the same one that the democratic world is facing, that we are seeing a continuously more assertive Chinese regimes that are trying to topple the rule-based world order and to legitimize themselves and to denounce democracy. And that's what they've done in Hong Kong for the past years and what they're actively doing around the world.
In the documentary, Nathan, you say that you will see a free Hong Kong in your lifetime. The agreement was made in 1997 for 50 years. It expires in 2047. And there have been a rollback of certain rights. You well know this. You've been on the streets protesting this. You've been jailed for this. You have been exiled for this. So what gives you this hope?
For me, having the hope of returning to Hong Kong, sometimes it's not logical. It's not like a calculation, like how many years until the Chinese Communist Party fell apart and then we can go back to Hong Kong. But it's more like it's a faith. It's the belief that we trust that people have an innate pursuit of freedom. And when the time comes, they will rise and they will fight for what they deserve. And for me, I think that is a long road. Like, democratic movement is a marathon and Hong Kong people has been through a few decades of it, but definitely we haven't really had enough effort and campaign for the role for democracy. And I think in the following decades, Hong Kong people, even though we are aboard, even though we are still in the city, we will use our ways to continue to manifest the pursuit for democracy and to campaign. And I'm 31 now. I have a few decades to go, and I genuinely believe that I will see a free and democratic Hong Kong in my lifetime.
Take good care of yourself, okay? It was really good to talk to you. Thanks, Nathan.
Thanks, Pia.
Nathan Law is a Hong Kong democracy activist and the subject of a new documentary called Who's Afraid of Nathan Law? You're listening to the Sunday Magazine podcast. I'm Pia Chattopadhyay. From his rise in the New York real estate scene to hosting a popular reality show that offered winners the chance to become his business partner, Donald Trump has long touted his financial success as a main reason he's suited to not only run his family business, but also his country. But Suzanne Craig has built a case that the long-running image Trump has presented as a savvy deal-making billionaire is all just an illusion. Suzanne's a Canadian investigative journalist with the New York Times. She has a new book out. It is co-authored with her colleague Ross Buettner, and it's called Lucky Loser, How Donald Trump Squandered His Father's Fortune and Created the Illusion of Success. Sue, good morning to you.
Good morning, Pia. Thank you for having me.
Yeah, thanks for being with us. This is really a deep dive and a fascinating one at that about the financial picture of Donald Trump and your reporting on his finances. Really kicked off back in 2016 when you get this unmarked envelope in your work mailbox. Kind of a journalist's dream, right? Those manila envelopes we learn about in journalism school. When you open it up, what was inside?
Well, it is a great thing about journalism. You sort of come in to work every day and you're not sure what you're going to find. Most days you don't find three pages of Donald Trump's tax returns in your mailbox. But that day in September 2016, I did, and I went to the mailbox. I was actually closing a story that day. I was really busy, but I went by my mailbox. I love mail as a separate thing. So I check it a lot, and there was a manila envelope there addressed to me, and I opened it. The three pages of Donald Trump's 1995 tax returns were there. We, of course, didn't know if it was real, and we had to authenticate it, but it showed that year he had accumulated losses of almost $1 billion. Mm-hmm. And we worked round the clock to confirm that the pages were real. And we ended up reaching the accountant who signed it, who confirmed it. I have to tell you, it's really hard to get tax returns. And sometimes it's even harder to confirm them because so few people can. It's the signator who can confirm them. Sometimes if there's an outside accountant, there may be a few other people in the office who can. But we found the accountant, and he actually remembered the whole thing. There was something that concerned us about the document, which is that there was different typeface on some of the numbers in that loss. It was very large. And we thought, well, maybe somebody's, pulling our leg and they've typed in you know, numbers to make them up, but the accountant said that the losses were so big that the program he used to file the taxes actually couldn't hold all those numbers. So he had to manually insert them with a typewriter.
Oh, wow.
Right.
Wow.
That kicked off sort of the last 9 years of my life, to be honest, if you can believe that.
So. I believe that. Did you know at the moment, like when you open them up, I know you have to verify, this is what we do as journalists, but did you have that moment where you're like, if these are real, holy schmoly?
Yeah, I actually thought that. And I also thought it's more likely than not a prank. And then the other thing I thought was that if it was me and I had those tax returns and I was sending them around, I'd be sending them around to a lot of reporters around either the city or the New York Times. And I went as far as to, and we had some other people help, we checked every mailbox at the New York Times to see if there was other pages. And we were very worried that other newspapers had potentially gotten them. And one other New York newspaper did get them, but they didn't manage to confirm them. We had to get it right. If we got it wrong, it would have been just devastating for the Times. But once we got confirmation from the accountant and went to Donald Trump, we felt confident about it and went with the story. But it was crazy. And I look back to 2015 and 16, you know, we've done a lot of work since then, Rasputner and I, my partner, on this. But that year and that story in particular was so explosive because he became the front runner and he promised that he would release his tax returns. And there was this big chase that was going on among all reporters, rightly, to try and find out more information about his businesses, which included his taxes. But his company was privately held. And people didn't even know. I did one story on just what does he own and what does he not own, because his name is on so many buildings that he doesn't own.
Yeah.
But sort of there was this race on. So when that story ran, it just felt seismic to me as a reporter, you know, who's, and I even since having done other stories, you know, one won the Pulitzer, that story still sticks in my mind, is just so much larger than life.
Yeah, it was seismic. It was a bombshell. And Donald Trump was very annoyed by it. During that election campaign, too, he refuses to publish his tax return, saying that it was because it was under audit. So how did you keep digging to find these documents when Trump was so dead fast on keeping them out of the public eye? Like, where did you get like the corroboration and to move the story forward?
Right, because it's like anything. If you don't get a story after a while of journalism, your editor's like, well, what have you done for me lately? So we kind of just kept going, but we kept getting stories. And the next story, I think, is really important to the larger picture and is really fits in to the book Russ and I wrote, Lucky Loser, about his father's wealth. And you know, roughly a third of the book deals with his father and Donald Trump's relationship with the father. But what happened next was, so we get that story and the election happens and Donald Trump is elected. And then other stories are running in other publications. And one day a story ran and somebody called me and they said, you know, you should really look into Fred Trump. What we knew a bit about Fred Trump. We knew he was an outer borough builder and that he came from some wealth. But of course, we're focused rightly on trying to find out information about Donald Trump, now the president of the United States. And there was a lot of stories at the time I was writing them about the conflicts that him being in the White House presented. But we got this call and it intrigued me. So we started out and there was three of us, including Russ, who I wrote the book with. And we started digging into just at first property records in New York. They're public, just to find out what Fred Trump owned. And this picture came into focus that he owned, you know, dozens of buildings that were worth, you know, potentially up to $1 billion. We couldn't believe it. Donald Trump would go on to inherit some of that. But that led us on a journey where, as we were going through these public records, there's always names on them, and you see accountants' names. And one of the names that popped up frequently was that of Mary Trump and Fred Trump III. That's his niece and nephew. And the reason that it would come up occasionally is their father died in his early 40s. It was really a tragic death. He died of alcoholism, and he's a character in our book. But we realized that they had inherited some of the buildings, and then there was a sale in 2000. And where I'm going with this is they felt they were cut out of Fred Trump Sr.'s will after their father died, and there was litigation in 2000. And the litigation had gone to discovery. And that's a magic word for journalists. That means that there was a lot of documents turned over. We didn't know exactly what was turned over, but we decided Mary Trump and Fred Trump were people we should see. And we realized that Fred Trump, her brother, not the father, they all seem in the Trump family to have the same name. So, but Fred Trump III had some connections to the family. So we went to his sister, Mary, and I actually just knocked on her door one day to talk to her. I went to her door rather than calling because I wanted to convey the importance of my talking to her and also just to let her know that I knew a lot about the family businesses and names that only really she would probably know. She wasn't receptive at first, but eventually she decided to sit down with me. She didn't know what was in those boxes, but she agreed to go to her lawyer's office, and she got a van and she got the documents for us. She drove them to her house and transferred them to a car that we had. And we drove them to the New York Times, and we had a room set up that only Russ and I and the other reporter, three of us, had access to. Wow. And we started to go through them. And the documents it was like an Alice in Wonderland moment. And they just opened up a whole new world for us where we could see not only the inner workings of Fred Trump, but we got even his gift tax returns back to when Donald Trump was born. We could see each year how much money he was giving his children. We began to understand things like Fred Trump owned two massive housing projects called Beach Haven and Shore Haven in the New York area. He owned them, and he put the land under them in a trust for his children. And we just started to see the multitude of ways that Donald Trump was transferring money to his children. And then we also saw, and this was both through the documents that we got from Mary Trump and a lot of reporting that we did, that there was tax fraud involved in some of the transfer of money later in Fred's life to his children. Because at the time, so Fred Trump, you imagine Donald Trump, and everybody probably is thinking, you know, he's got a lot of debt, he gives personal obligations when he's signing loans, he does things that Fred Trump never did. Fred Trump believed that cash was king. He had a lot of cash that he had in his, just, you know, in the various buildings and the companies. And if he died at any moment, that would be subject to estate tax at the time of roughly 50%. So Donald Trump and his siblings designed a scheme to drain that cash. And it amounted to tax fraud. And we talked to a lot of experts on it, and we wrote a story on that. And that was the story that won a Pulitzer Prize in 2019. And then we kept going, and we ended up I still can't believe it, but we ended up, I got, after that story, somebody else called me, as things happen in journalism, and they said, I've got 20 years of Donald Trump's personal and corporate tax returns, and I'd like to get them to you. And we met with this individual, and that unlocked just another incredible door for us into his modern finances. And we saw a few things that I think are important for people to know. One is that pretty much most of his businesses lose money, but that he got an incredible amount of money from The Apprentice, more than we could have imagined, in excess of $400 million between the money he made off product integration from the show. That's when, you know, a corporation will sponsor an episode on The Apprentice, and they want their product featured, and then the licensing deal. So it was like a second inheritance that he got from.
You know, Sue, when you talk about the family wealth, Donald Trump has always claimed that his inheritance from his father was small. And you write about how he squandered a lot of his dad's money after taking over the family business. How do you square what he says publicly with what your reporting has found?
What he says publicly is a lie. And I think the reason that he does it, it's interesting because this goes back to when he was a kid. And I think by making his father look small, he looks larger. He wants a hardscrabble story. It's a very attractive story to him. Not It was very useful in him selling himself to the American people when he ran for president the first time, and he continues to cling to it. But he has been doing it since the 1970s. We went back through all the press clippings from the 70s, the 80s, the 90s, and we first start seeing signs of it when he is quite young. He's just started out working for his father. And there's a profile of him in the New York Times, in the paper that I work for. And he claims in that story that he is worth roughly $200 million. The New York Times didn't verify it. They printed it. And over the years, he starts to say he's worth more. And by the time in the 1980s, we see him, he is on 60 Minutes, and they are calling him, without any evidence, a billionaire. And in hindsight, it's really frustrating to see because, you know, of what happened and the power that he gained and his ability. You know, he was in the White House, he became president. But at the time, the reason I think it wasn't verified is because he really was more a celebrity in New York than he was a businessman. Even I worked at the Wall Street Journal, and we would write about him there, not me specifically, but the Wall Street Journal is very focused on public companies, rightly, that report quarterly and have shareholders to report to. Donald Trump reported only to Donald Trump. And the other thing that Donald Trump was very successful about that fueled the idea that he was wealthy is he early on identified the importance of ingratiating himself and befriending people in the media. He often phoned up Larry King, and he got on shows like Lifestyles of the Rich and Famous, the one Robin Leach hosted, and he had the accoutrements of wealth. He had helicopters, he had boats, he had things that appealed to that wealth porn culture that we saw really come of age in the 1980s.
I guess the question then becomes, Sue, though, that it takes two to tango. So you explore how the news media, and you've laid out some of it there, helped create this myth of Donald Trump as a successful businessman. Yeah. But how culpable are journalists in building up this illusion of Donald Trump?
I think they bear a lot of responsibility. And we talk about that in the book. We reached out to so many people, including former colleagues of mine at the Wall Street Journal, who spoke to him at the time. And some of it was, you know, he would claim there were stories in the Wall Street Journal where he would claim, like, for example, the 1987 crash, he claimed that he sold all his stock before the crash. And it became somewhat evident not long after that he didn't. And then Russ Buettner and I got his tax returns, and it was clear that he hadn't sold. And people chalk it up to the churn of the day. I'm a reporter. I've phoned people on deadline, and sometimes you take people at their word. But I think Donald Trump, what was frustrating about him is he took advantage of people who place trust in other people. You know, he would just lie without any shame. And it's frustrating to see it because it created this person that had the appearance of wealth. And it goes down not just to even reporters. You know, he was effective in that way, in repeating a lie over and over and over until it became passed down into history as truth. But the banks also are culpable. They lent him money they never should have. And it all came crashing down on them at some point. But I do, in the book, really does explore this, just both the media and the banks bear responsibility for what happened.
I'm curious, as you say, he has posed unique challenges for journalists. What challenges has he presented for you?
You know, I think for me as a journalist, he is on the one hand a great subject, which I'm thankful for, but it's really frustrating to cover somebody who does just lies without any, just like he breathes. And we've been covering him now for 9 years. And I remember being on calls where he would have lawyers say that the information that we have is just wrong. We were confident it was right. But we have, you know, lawyers for somebody in the White House saying that it's wrong. And it's, you have to, and we would circle back. We would take more time. Our editors would say, take another month and let's get more information just to buckle this up. So it slow walks that. And then, but we go forward. We know it's right. But it does make you pause when somebody in the White House is saying it's wrong. And he has sued me. He sends cease and desist letters frequently after we publish stories. There's a lot of things I think that don't bother him about the media, and things are a lot of things do bother him about what's said about him in the media. But what's written about him, about his finance and his money, is particularly a sensitive subject for him. You saw it just the other night in the debate with Kamala Harris. She really got under his skin, and one of the questions and comments that she made about him was how he inherited $400 million. And he came back again with that hard scrabble story that he did it all by himself. And that the idea that he inherited roughly $400 million, which is, you know, the financial work that Russ Buettner and I did, you know, to when we were working on that 2018 story, he says it's just wrong. Yeah.
You said he has sued you many times. Just for the record, has he ever been successful in suing you for your reporting?
He hasn't. He's sued me. He's threatened to sue me a few times, and he has sued me once. And that was an interesting case. It was in New York, and he sued both myself, my colleague Russ Buettner, and another colleague, David Barstow, and the New York Times, but also sued us with Mary Trump. And the reason that he sued us is he said he's arguing against Mary Trump because in 2000, when they settled that lawsuit where we got a lot of information from a lot of those boxes of documents, that she had signed a confidentiality agreement that said that she wouldn't talk about him or mm-hmm. give out the documents. That's his case. That's his side of that. And she came to a financial settlement with him. And then he was suing myself and my colleagues in the Times, accusing me of torturous interference he's arguing I coerced her to give over the documents. And in that case, there's laws in New York about filing frivolous lawsuits. Interesting, the origins of them and the laws came about because Donald Trump was filing so many. But the judge threw out the case against the New York Times and my colleagues. The case against Mary Trump is moving forward. But in that case, Donald Trump was ordered and has paid our legal fees for the case. They came to roughly $400,000, and we got a check for that.
We are 6 weeks away from an election. What is his financial situation like today, Sue Craig?
We don't have a great window into it now. We have tax returns up to 2018, but there are some observations that I would make. We know when he announced his candidacy for president back in 2015, that a lot of the licensing partners that he had, they parted ways with him. He'd made some disparaging comments about immigrants at the time, and that money dried up, and that money was already sort of, it was falling off, but it really just dropped off a cliff at that point. We also know that he has sold some assets, some not so quietly and some quietly. One of the ones that some people may have heard of is that he had a lease to a hotel in Washington, the old post office hotel. That hotel cost him a fortune to build. It was losing a lot of money, and he sold that hotel. He's also gotten rid of a golf course in the New York area, and he's been selling condominium units in New York. And I think they're seeing a small kind of downsizing of the Trump Organization. But then he's launched into sort of almost a martyrism business, where he's selling shoes and Bibles. And these are all licensing deals. They're nothing like the ones I would he had. But he's sort of moving into more of that area than luxury branding. But I think the important thing to know about his finances is that he's facing huge fines, you know, upwards of $500 million in New York for a few cases that he's had, including a civil case that the New York Attorney General brought. And that case, if it is upheld on appeal, could cost him $400 to $500 million. It's a crushing number. Nobody has that much cash sitting around, and he had trouble getting the bond together for it.
Sue, it's, as I said at the beginning, a really deep dive and a fascinating and interesting one at that, your book. And I thank you for sharing with us today. I really appreciate it.
Yeah, thank you. And it was an honor to be on the show. I listen down here to Sunday.
We appreciate you. So, congratulations on your recent Order of Canada as well.
Thank you very much.
Take good care. Suzanne Craig is an investigative journalist with the New York Times. She is the co-author of the new book, which is called Lucky Loser, How Donald Trump Squandered His Father's Fortune and Created the Illusion of Success. I'm Pia Chattopadhyay, and you are listening to the Sunday Magazine podcast. For decades now, Guy Vanderhaeghe has been one of Canada's most widely read and widely celebrated writers of literary fiction. His novels and stories, from his Western trilogy, including The Englishman's Boy, to his latest, August Into Winter, have been rooted in our country's history. They've also earned Guy 3 Governor General's Awards. What's less widely known about Guy Vanderhaeghe, though, is that he's a gifted nonfiction writer as well, though it seems he only really gets down to writing it when someone asks him to. That is why he has called his new collection of nonfiction works, Because Somebody Asked Me To. Guy Vanderhaeghe, good morning. It's nice to have you back.
Good morning. It's lovely to be here.
Your book is not a memoir, but it sure feels a bit like one. And I'm just wondering, have you ever considered just sitting down and writing the memoir?
I was asked to write a memoir maybe about 10 years ago, and my reply to that was that a writer's life isn't all that fascinating. Most of the time is spent staring at the wall, and unless you've gambled about the world going to wars like Hemingway did, it wouldn't be too fascinating reading.
Okay. You are familiar with the old saying, though, Guy, that there are no dull subjects, just dull writers. You are not a dull writer. And so to work out that math equation, I would say you're not a dull subject either.
That's flattering. but I can't see myself through anybody's eyes. I can only see myself through my own eyes. And when I look at the mirror, I look pretty dull.
We're still going to talk about your life, and because I find it interesting, especially when you talk about your upbringing and about your influences along the way. So you grew up in Esterhazy, Saskatchewan in the 1950s. Tell us, what was that like, Guy?
Well, I often say that, you know, I'm a writer of historical fiction because in some sense I lived in the 19th century. My parents, the first house that I remember, we lived with my grandparents in a tiny house until I was about 4 or 5, was actually a two-room house that consisted of a kitchen and a bedroom. It had electricity, but no running water. It had a wood stove, no refrigerator. One of my chores as a child was to go to the next door neighbors and bring water home. And because I was only 6 years old, I could only bring about a quarter of a pail at a time. So it was, how would I put it, quite primitive, obviously. There was no television in my household until I was 13, which I think contributed to me being a reader. It was kind of a hard scrabble life. And you know, the one thing about poverty is that poor people often don't know that they're poor until it's pointed out to them. So I'm not suggesting that I had an unhappy childhood, simply that in retrospect, it was a childhood that would be very different from many other people's childhoods at that time.
And Guy, that childhood, obviously helped pave the way to the writing and the writer you've become all these years later. In this new collection of your works, you ponder a series of what-if questions, and some of them date back to your childhood. So I just want to go through them because they tell this great story about your life and development as a writer. So first you write, what if my mother hadn't been so determined to see that I got an education? Where did that determination come from her?
I think in some sense, like a lot of women of her generation, she had served in the Canadian Women's Army Corps in the Second World War. She'd been a sergeant major. She'd held a position of responsibility. And I can testify that she was very sergeant major-like in terms of keeping my nose to the grindstone. When she came back from the war, like virtually every woman of her generation, she was supposed to forget the experiences that she had and settle for domesticity. I don't think she was ever particularly happy in domesticity. I think that she had aspirations, and to a certain extent, they got pushed on to me. I became her surrogate for the life that maybe she wished she had had.
And you write that for your mom, that the education was the way, the way of escaping the small town boredom and dead-end jobs that had been her lot.
Yeah, and I mean, I think that though my parents were born in this country, for instance, immigrant families, they seize upon education as a way up and out of their circumstances. That was certainly true of my mother. She always used to say to you, they can take everything else away from you, but they can't take what you have in your head.
Mm. And she was determined that you wouldn't share the lot that she had, so to speak.
Yeah, and I stumbled often. I mean, and it was kind of her who sort of dragged me back on track.
Another what if, you ask, Guy, is what if I had not spent so many hours in smoky kitchens listening to my uncles tell stories? So set that scene for us. You write the no holds barred verbal brawl that happened when your mom's family got together.
All of my uncles were great storytellers, and they were very funny people. And they had stories to tell because almost all of them had served in the Second World War, and they'd been everywhere from, you know, North Africa to the Low Countries to Italy, and they had great stories. One of my uncles used to tell stories about how he would hoodwink the Anglican chaplain into giving him good character references when he was up on a court-martial charge, and his run-ins with a psychiatrist who he managed to bamboozle, and stories about the strange, bizarre business of Canadian troops being in England, and two of my uncles were gunners in the artillery. But initially they had to practice with 22s mounted on gun carriages because they didn't have the equipment to practice. They were fantastic storytellers, and I picked up, I think, an oral tradition of storytelling. I mean, I've always been interested in writing dialogue and in writing the way people speak, and they were great models for that. Mm. And they were great characters.
And so these great stories your uncles told, especially from their experiences in the war years, if they are sort of a paragon of what a great story is, Guy, what did you sort of take away or remember taking away about the power of story and storytelling?
I think what I took away was they had a very strong sense of beginning, middle, and end. They knew where they were taking a story, and I suspect that they often altered the story to make it as complete and as polished as possible. I think like all storytellers, whether they are oral storytellers or whether they put their stories down on paper, it's kind of very important to have what I often refer to as narrative drive. That is that a story is aimed in a certain direction, and your job as the writer or teller is to get it to the point where you want it to go.
Mm. And what route you take to get there.
Exactly.
Okay, your next what if that you write about, Guy, is what if I hadn't had access to a library without any conditions set on what I could read? Now, first of all, I understand that your school library in Esterhazy burned to the ground when you were young, right?
I had nothing to do with it, but the library burned in the summer before I went to school for the first time in grade one. And then all the money in the town went to building a new building. Everything in the school had been destroyed, textbooks, library books, which I suspect there weren't very many of before it did burn down. So for the first couple of years of my life, there was a room that was called the school library, but there wasn't very much in it or almost nothing in it because there was no money to put books in there. Most of the town's tax money had gone into the building itself. And it was a very long time before this small town created a library. And when they did, it was a single room not much bigger than the studio that I'm sitting in, and many of the books were donated books. Now, it didn't have a librarian. It operated on the honor system. You went in there and you signed out a book and carried it away with you. So there was nobody supervising my reading, and I pulled down anything I wanted to, whether it was, as would be called now, age appropriate or not. My mother never supervised my reading. As she put it, as long as he's reading books, he's not running the streets. So she let me read virtually anything I wanted.
The other thing you read, Guy, along the way were comic books from the local drugstore that they would be throwing out because they weren't selling. These were classics, illustrated comics. How did reading comic books help shape you as a writer and storyteller, do you think?
Well, I think one of the things was is that they caught me when I was very young. But they were a particular kind of comic book. The classic illustrated series were kind of designed to be visual précis of books that were considered classics. So they even had Shakespeare plays. They had Dickens novels that were appeared in comic book form, Rudyard Kipling, Robert Louis Stevenson, a whole series of writers. These were the writers who weren't in my library. So my first experience of them were classic comic books. Secondly, in the back of classic comic books, they had little potted biographies of the writers. And I actually used to study these things, trying to discover if there was a common theme or characteristic that made somebody a writer. Because at a very early age, I wanted to be a writer. Mm-hmm. And I started writing when I was 6 years old. I often say that at that time, I couldn't distinguish between writing and reading. Everything was story to me. Mm. And if I didn't have something to read, I started making up my own stories. When I went to a movie, I would continue the story of the movie in my own mind and actually act it out or play it out in my backyard. So from a very early age, I was obsessed with narrative and with stories.
I'm Pia Chattopadhyay, and if you're just joining us, the voice you're hearing is Guy Vanderhaeg, the celebrated Canadian novelist. We are talking, I guess, less about his novels today, more about himself and how Guy came to be the great novelist that he is. He has a new collection of nonfiction pieces out. It's called Because Someone Asked Me To. From a very young age, Guy, you've already got the dream of being a writer, and then you set out later on in life to become a writer. You'd been writing and writing and writing. And you'd been facing rejection, rejection, rejection for your stories. It's a familiar story for many aspiring writers, especially young ones. But you tell a story in your book about a bold move that you decided to make, finally. And you get on the phone with the big canlit publisher, Macmillan. What happens next?
Well, Macmillan had my manuscript for quite a long time, and they'd been making encouraging noises. They would tell me, well, wait a little bit longer. We have to consider this manuscript. Short stories don't sell very well, which is true, all the rest of it. And my frustration just kept building and building. And I kind of felt like the donkey who's dangled with the carrot in front of his nose. And as long as I marched down this path, I didn't seem to get any closer to getting a book published. So I did an incredibly stupid thing. I phoned the publisher and I gave him an ultimatum. And I said, if I don't hear from you by Friday afternoon at 5 o'clock, I'm pulling the book, and no matter what you do, I'm just withdrawing it. And I, you know, if you come back to me and say you want to publish it, I will say no. That, I'm sure, was actually a lie, but that's what I told him. Uh-huh. So for a week, I sat beside the phone. When Friday rolled around, I knew it was hopeless. So my wife and I said, well, let's walk downtown, which is what we did. We lived in an area of Saskatoon called Sutherland, so it was a long walk from Sutherland to get downtown. We decided that we would have lunch in a Vietnamese restaurant, and no matter how economical that meal was, it was still a strain on the budget. And then I went home, and I actually arrived home the way I remember it, maybe about 4:30 on Friday afternoon. And almost exactly at 5 o'clock, the phone rang, and the publisher told me that they were going to publish my book. I think there was some nicety in the timing of that phone call. I think he was letting me know that maybe I had pushed it too far, but I got the acceptance. And I'm not saying that I got the acceptance because I made this outrageous ultimatum that was coming from an absolutely unknown writer that nobody had ever heard of. But I was very, very lucky, and luck has played a big part in my career. Mm.
Luck and determination, though, right, Guy? Because in those early years, most especially, you didn't give up writing and submitting despite those rejections, despite the dwindling funds, where many people choose to or in some cases have to. And I'm just wondering what it is about you. And, you know, as a fellow Saskatchewanian, I wondered, does being from, like, especially rural Saskatchewan, that upbringing you talked about in the 1950s, perhaps at least partially explain why you were, I don't know, just able to keep working at it?
Maybe. I mean, I think that raised the way I was, I didn't have many material expectations. I knew that I could live on very little. And luckily, the woman I married had many of the same aspirations that I had. She was a painter. And in a sense, there was an agreement about what we considered important in our lives. She wanted to paint, and I wanted to write, and we supported each other. So there was actually no division in the household over that, which eased things considerably. There was another factor that when I was in my late 20s, I was diagnosed with type 1 diabetes. And at that time, the prospects of a lengthy life as a type 1 diabetic were pretty minimal. And the prospects have actually gotten much, much better for a whole bunch of reasons. And I said to myself, if I'm going to attempt to do this, I'm going to attempt to do it now. And one of the things about rejection is that it made me more determined to prove the rejectors wrong. Hmm. And I got some really great rejectors. I often speak of my last name, which is a strange in its spelling, a strange clashing of vowels and consonants that don't belong together. In the early 70s, as strange as it may seem, it seemed like a foreign name to many people. And I remember getting a rejection letter that suggested to me that I should write in my first language.
Ooh.
I thought, okay.
That's just cruel on so many levels, yeah.
Well, no, but all sorts of assumptions are made about people, okay? And assumptions made on the color of their skin or their religion or their names or anything else. And unfortunately, those assumptions are hurdles that you have to get over. I used to tell my creative writing students that writing is talent, but it's also determination and it's doggedness. There were three people when I went to university, we were friends, and we confessed the dirty little secret to each other that we wanted to be writers. I think the other two people were more natural writers than I was, and more talented writers than I was. But for all sorts of reasons, maybe because they could do something else other than what I could do, I couldn't do very much except write or teach, they abandoned writing. But I stuck to it. And it wasn't easy. I remember an aunt who said of me, he has all that education and he just won't work.
Hmm.
And I was a writer who was publishing at that point.
You write in this book that when you reflect on the path that you have taken, that the only thing that strikes you is, quote, how improbable it is that I became a writer. Does it still feel that way to you, improbable?
Absolutely. I mean, in one sense, it's seems even more improbable than it did when I was beginning. There are two things that you can do when you get to be my age. You can construct the story of your life from the point where you find yourself, and then you look back at the evidence that brought you there. But you can also say, what if I hadn't completed my high school, which was a possibility? That alone would have meant that I didn't become a writer. What if I hadn't gone to university? What if my mother hadn't actually signed me up for university and called me back from a job on an irrigation project in BC? I likely would have stayed there or continued doing that work. The other thing about where I am now is that I've never had a lot of confidence, okay? And there are many times when my confidence could have been broken if I hadn't got an assist from somebody else. That is, somebody who encouraged me. I mean, in this collection of stories, I talk about receiving a letter from Margaret Lawrence out of the blue. And she gave me advice, and she ended the letter by saying that she cared about me because, quote, I had the gift, right? That was enormously important to me, particularly at that point, because I didn't have much confidence. You know, like Blanche DuBois, I've relied on the kindness of strangers many times.
Well, we're very happy that you found your way to being one of Canada's great writers, to that determination, and as you say, some luck and the encouragement of others. Thanks a lot, Guy. It's been good to talk to you.
Thank you very much, Pia.
Guy Vanderhaeghe's new collection is called Because Somebody Asked Me To, Observations on History, Literature, and the Passing Scene. All right, that's it for this week on The Sunday Magazine. Our team is Levi Garber, Brianna Goss, Andrea Huang, Pete Minton, Aronde Williams, and Lou Joe. We had additional help from audio technician Emily Chiarvasio. Our senior producer is Howard Goldenthal. Our executive producer is Brian Colton. cbc.ca/Sunday is the place to stream and share all of today's stories. You can get our podcast there as well. And you can share your thoughts with us on our show by sending an email to sunday@cbc.ca. Join me here once again in 1 week's time when I'll be speaking with the wondrous Pulitzer Prize-winning author of The Overstory, Richard Powers, all about his epic new book. This one is called Playground. Looking forward to that conversation. I'm Pia Chattopadhyay. Thank you so very much for lending us your ear. Till next Sunday.
For more CBC podcasts, go to cbc.ca/podcasts.